from LPM.
Louisville Public Media.
Support for LPM podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
Hi, I'm Kyla.
And this is Jay.
And you're listening to Strange Fruit Podcast.
Welcome back to listeners. So, Doc, this is my final week. As I told listeners last week, I've been in Baltimore for the past 5 weeks. It's been so long.
I know.
So we were putting the show together rather remotely. Some episodes we kind of pre-recorded and put together, but the last few weeks we've been kind of, I've been recording myself here in Baltimore with a recorder. You're there in the studio. I'm on Skype. The guests are on Skype or in the studio on the phone. But we made it work. Cogent has made it work. Made us all sound wonderful. And we have pulled it off despite us being hundreds of miles apart.
Yes.
But I'll be home next week.
I'm so excited. I'm so excited for you to come home. I mean, this has been like the longest 5 weeks ever. At first it was like cool, but now I'm like, Noen.
You wanted me to come home? I miss you too. So listen, I'm also super excited to talk about today's guest. So it's been a couple months ago, I got the coolest kind of, it's not a book proposal, but like a book announcement. I got the coolest thing in my email several months ago about a really cool book that caught my attention. And so I just had to have the guest on. The book is called Hexing the Patriarchy, 26 Potions, Spells, and Magical Elixirs to Embolden the Resistance. That sounds very, very like titillating and alluring. And so without further ado, listeners, please welcome to the show journalist, novelist, and teacher Ariel Goer. Ariel, how are you?
Hi, good. Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. So, and I mentioned the book is called Hexing the Patriarchy, and it is quite literally a book with spells, potions, and magical elixirs, right? We're speaking both literally and figuratively here. So, I mean, so not to be reductive or basic, but let's start from the very beginning. Is this a book of witchcraft for the resistance?
Pretty much, yeah. I invited a bunch of witches and brujas and magic makers from all kinds of traditions to give me their best spells for beginners and advanced magic makers, for everybody can take part in hexing the patriarchy and getting this thing done with.
I love it. And when most people think about witches or brujas or those kind of things, they think about shows like True Blood or perhaps any other kind of fantastical or fantasy, or maybe they think about Halloween. But very few people who are outside of those traditions know about real life witches, real life brujas, real life soothsayers. Talk to us a bit about what you mean when you call someone a healer or a magic maker or a witch. You know, that's not some kind of person with a pointy nose and a top hat. What is a real life witch, and what do you all do?
Well, yeah, most of the witches I know do not wear pointy hats and
or ride brooms.
although, you know, they can if they want to. Some people like that style. but yeah, most witches are, you know, you see them on the street, you wouldn't know one from the next. Some witches are also Christian. Some witches are also Jewish. So it's a very non-hierarchical spiritual system. There are a lot of initiatory magical traditions too, and some of those type of magic makers and witches and Olorishas are included in this book as well. So it's really people from all kinds of healing and hexing magical traditions who, yeah, they don't look necessarily like the folks on Halloween cards. And they're, you know, pretty much not involved with Satan. Satan is a Christian invention. So they're kind of pagan, earth-based religions. And we're just sitting at home doing our little incantations, making sure that this impeachment keeps going, trying to protect our communities. so it's very, you know, it's very kind of earthy, and we've done a lot of events with these folks who are included in this book. And when you see them walking up, you wouldn't necessarily know that they're casting all kinds of wild spells.
Yeah, yeah. So talk to us a bit about about when you, well, you describe in the book when you were formally initiated into the witchhood, I guess. And you say that you were 21 years old, you were a single mom, like welfare was kicking your butt, you had student loans, like family court judges, governors, like the world went to shit, for lack of a better term, right? And so all these things kind of what led you to a particular point where you decided, like, yeah, talk about that. Like, what, like, at what age did you kind of take an interest in witchcraft? And then what happened around the age of 21 that led you to formally kind of initiate yourself into the tradition?
Yeah, it's like you said. I was a teen mom. I was 21 now. I was in school. I was really in poverty. I was just learning about feminism, and the Family Values Campaign was going on. So it was like, you know, welfare mothers were the root of all evil. And I just felt a general kind of powerlessness in my life, and some of it was very real. And this is something, witchcraft was something that was presented to me as a feminist spirituality. And the thing that really appealed to me about it is that there's always something you can do. So, you know, if you need rent money, there is a spell for that. If you need to just feel better about yourself, there's a spell for that. If you need to smash the patriarchy, there's a spell for that. And some of these, you know, sometimes it's not abracadabra, sometimes it doesn't happen instantly, but there's something that you can do. And there is a sense of empowerment in that, for lack of a better word. Whereas, you know, a lot of the sort of hierarchical or patriarchal religions are like, no, you just have to still try to be a good person to all these people who are abusing you, and maybe someday you'll go to heaven. So this really appealed to me on more of a survival level. And, you know, part of the thing that patriarchy and racism and capitalism and homophobia take from us is just our confidence and our ability to move in the world as confident people who feel good about ourselves. And so even though there's still going to be these very concrete challenges, witchcraft gave to me more just like confidence. Like, you know, I'm badass. Like, I don't know about you all and what, you know, you all are trying to say about my family, but I'm badass, and these are the things I'm going to do now.
No, yes, and we love it, because it does. Patriarchy, misogyny, homophobia, it all prevents you from, as you say, right in your introduction, stepping into your spiritual, your own spiritual authority. And so now that you feel solid in that spiritual authority, in that divinity, you also talked about how you practice a bunch of different spiritual systems, from Wicca to spiritualism in general, to Santeria, to Vodun. Talk a bit about you learning from Ifa and that tradition, Santeria, Voodoo, and how that and those traditions are involved in your spiritualism and your witchcraft.
Yeah, when I was first interested in witchcraft, I was living in Northern California, and the traditions around me were mostly Wicca. Then my daughter and I moved down to the Bay Area, where I'm originally from, and the spiritual tradition that was more inviting to us there was Orisha-based and Voodoo. And, you know, I'm a white witch, so I think it's important to note that I take part only when expressly invited. And when I started first getting involved, I think I was in the 90s, and we didn't have as much of an understanding about appropriation. But I think that there is always, with all these magical traditions, the basis is really respect and listening to people who are more marginalized than yourself. So you learned that without knowing that word per se, I really learned that and learned to listen and take part in these traditions that maybe some of them my own ancestors were involved in, and some of them they very much weren't. And they in California, all these traditions came together in this really cool way, and in a way that we could support each other and kind of protect our communities.
Okay, so no, so all of those things, you know, kind of led you to this spiritual path. So for you, how, and again, you kind of explained it and you kind of unpacked it when you talked about, you know, recognizing privilege and identifying with folks who are more marginalized in terms of race or those types of identities. So what really kind of drew you? Was it the life experiences that you had with systems of oppression that kind of wanted, that led you to fuse spirituality and, you know, kind of debunking or, you know, kind of like what was the tie for you for your connecting spirituality to social justice?
Well, I've always had that in my background. My stepdad, who was the sort of dad who raised me, was a Catholic priest. He was excommunicated when he married my mom. But his Catholicism was very much that kind of Catholic worker liberation theology. So while it was Christian, my understanding of spirituality was always that it was very much tied to social justice and very much tied to, you know, a lot of Christians have that basis for their spiritual tradition, and whether it's, you know, feeding their communities or really putting themselves on the line in terms of defending people who are more marginalized than themselves. So, you know, the Catholics that I grew up with were doing work in Central America and doing work around, you know, prison injustice and all that kind of thing. So for me, they were always tied together. And one of the frustrating things with, for example, the Family Values Campaign was that, you know, that religion is used against people who are more marginalized than the people who are using it. And that's really kind of against the way that I was taught about spirituality. And so that was something really hard to swallow, you know, from anything from choice, mm-hmm. or, you know, where my understanding is that as humans first, but as spiritual people, we kind of empower each other and we want everybody to feel like they've got options. And you're not told, you know, you've got to kind of ignore your own spiritual authority and do this thing I'm telling you to do. And of course, religion has been used in that manner for so many of us in so many contexts. And it's one of the reasons I think that progressive people sometimes shy away from spirituality, because they want to say like, no, you know, this is all science based. You know, this God thing has been used against us too much. So we're going to pretend that that's not part of our lives. And I think it's often a huge part of our lives, but something that we didn't talk about in a lot of kind of lefty circles for a while there. Also in feminist circles, you know, especially around issues of choice, misogyny, patriarchy in general, you know, whether it's okay to get a divorce, things like that, that where religion was really used against us, we wanted to step away from that. But I've really found that, you know, all these magical traditions are so aligned with feminism, and feminism kind of leads to them, and so does environmentalism. These are earth-based traditions, so these are traditions in which we see ourselves as part of the earth and as cooperative in the same way that I think, you know, when you're talking about social justice, that all these traditions are really aligned with making sure that the, you know, the most marginalized or the most disempowered among us that we're all gathering around to support and protect each other.
No. I mean, certainly I completely agree because I want you to talk to our listeners about how you say that magic doesn't require them, like, if they want to use magic, if they're interested in the things you're saying, if they want to read your book and, like, feel inspired, that magic and performing magic and spells doesn't require them to adopt a complete different religion altogether. Explain that to our listeners, how they can practice magic, do spells in your book, but somehow not betray their own religious background.
Right. We would, you know, I think that the cool thing for me about magic in general and the spells in this book in particular are that they certainly don't require you to negate any other religion. Like I said, a lot of witches are Christian, a lot of witches are Jewish, a lot of witches are Muslim, a lot of, you know, it's, you can be all these things. And even within the magical traditions that I've worked with and studied, is that none of them have ever asked me to kind of renounce the others. I think that's, again, something that we get from the, mostly from a Judeo-Christian traditions, is this, you know, you're excommunicated from this one, or, you know, you have to walk away from one tradition in order to adopt the other. And that's not what we're talking about here. I mean, you may decide to convert to a different religion, but in these magical spells are very much for everyone. And they're, and if there's anything, like, you know, the thing I like about magic is if there's ever anything that makes you uncomfortable, you know, you might look at it and be like, okay, has the patriarchy put this discomfort or this fear in me? And you might want to question that. But by the same token, like, if there's anything that makes you uncomfortable, you don't have to do it. You know, if you join a coven and they start dancing around praying to something that you're not comfortable with, you're allowed to leave. Like, the coolest thing about witchcraft is you are empowered to say no, and you're empowered to say yes to things that please you, regardless of, you know, whether somebody told you that was sinful. If you're not hurting anybody, then it's not sinful. And likewise, if there's anything that you're not comfortable with, you don't have to do it. Most witches, like, you get this idea from whether it's a media thing or religions that don't like witches that we're running around doing these scary things, when in fact, you know, most witches are like burning incense at home and saying a nice little incantation. Like, it's not really a scary thing.
I love it. I love it. So your book presents itself, Ariel, as kind of an alphabetical order in terms of spells and potions. And so you offer a particular letter. For every letter, you offer a theme and then also an elixir or a potion or a spell to go with that. So, for example, for A, we have ancestors, where you say we should hit up our dead ancestors, our dead relatives, to help us master the system. For B, and I love this one in this current Me Too movement, for B we have binding. Stop grabby assholes by tying up all their appendages. So walk us through that one, for example. So how might we turn to B in a binding spell, and how might, or what type of situation might we use a binding spell?
Well, the binding spell in this book is specifically about binding the past. And so talking about, like, past systems, and also there are the spells about, yeah, binding specific people. Like, there is a monthly binding spell that people do kind of en masse to bind the current president, to kind of, in an attempt to stop him from doing more harm. The binding spells are usually, you use a kind of magic that, where you have an artifact. So you make a thing that would represent the person or the time period or the ideas that you want to bind. And then you would tie string around them and do a type of ritual to not bind yourself to them. People worry about that. And so there are kind of witchcraft basic safety things that might include salt or different ritualistic visualizations or cleansing yourself so that you don't mistakenly kind of bind yourself to an ideology that you're trying to leave in the past.
Oh my God. Well, no, I mean, I love all of the names of the chapters. My favorites, Reclaiming Power for R, Y for Yemiya, and J for Justice Jars. So which one out of J for Justice Jars, R for Reclaiming Your Power, and Y for Yemiya, which one is your fave, if you have a fave? Like, which houses?
Oh, I love them so much.
best spells.
Justice Jars is really great. I mean, one of the first magics that I learned personally is this thing called honey pots, basically, where you're sweetening a judge to your position or something like that. So when this witch Danny Burleson suggested, well, I want to do these justice jars, we started calling them sour pots because she just fills them with glass and sometimes urine and, you know, just all the sort of vinegar and all these kind of things that she wants to, you know, that are sort of like maybe icky, and she will bury them in the ground if there's like a Proud Boys or whatever that they call themselves march. She and her witch buddies will bury them along the route to kind of hex and disempower those people. The Reclaiming Power spell is about calling on the goddess of transformation, and that's just it's a great spell for everyone. The Yemiya spell is written by a priestess of Yemiya and very specifically for people who are, may not be initiates. So again, a lot of some of the magical traditions in the book are initiatory traditions, but the spells that the people contributed were very consciously for anyone and everyone to use and be a part of it.
Yeah, I love it. So my favorite chapter, of course, well, not of course, my favorite chapter, though, is the letter F for fight songs. And that is just, that chapter seems to just reinforce the notion that even what some people call a mantra or a personal chant or meditation, that simply picking a song, you know, getting in the right headspace and jamming out to this playlist will help you get your shit together for the day, right? And so I love, and so like some of these things are actual spells or potions, but some things are really accessible for people who might not be, or who may be wary of witchcraft. But like you offer, for example, a playlist that ranges from Dolly Parton's 9 to 5 to Earth, Wind, and Fire's Boogie Wonderland to Rihanna's I'm So Hard. Like, the person picks the song that kind of embodies what they want to do, what they want to tackle, how they want to feel, and then you offer kind of some instructions for how to begin. So before you leave your house, you make your playlist, and then you get to where you're going, and you kind of center yourself. And so I just really, really love it. Ariel, this book is it's been such a cool thing to read.
Now, we talk about popular culture, and you have some throughout your book, and one of my favorite movies from childhood was The Craft. How well done, if you've seen it. Have you seen The Craft?
I did see The Craft, but it's been many years.
So do you remember at all?
I love that. That movie. I mean, of course, it's so cheesy in some parts, but I like that too. Like, I like campy stuff. I don't find it particularly, offensive or anything like that. I really liked it. Maybe I would feel differently now, but I don't think so. I thought it was.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask.
I thought it was pretty great.
I was going to ask you about that. I mean, since that is the kind of like foremost, it's like the most formidable pop culture kind of incorporation of spiritual systems and spirituality that's kind of tethered to social justice, right? They get revenge for the black girl who's being bullied by the, you know, popular white girl in it by doing this kind of hair spell and so on and so forth. So I was going to ask you how true or how accurate it was, but you answered.
Well, I wouldn't go into full accuracy, but
certainly it's inspiration. But certainly it's inspirational. We can aspire to have that
absolutely.
Level of witchcraft and pain is. So listeners, if you want more information, of course you can go to arielgore.com. That's arielgore.com. The book is called Hex and the Patriarchy, 26 Potions, Spells, and Magical Elixirs to Embolden the Resistance. And of course, that's by Seal Press. Ariel, it's been a delight talking to you. We wish you nothing.
Thank you so
but
much
positivity
for having me.
And good spells. And thank you for giving us this toolkit to do some real damage to the patriarchy. And we wish you the best.
Oh, good. Yeah, you too.
Bye. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.
All right, Doc, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we have another wonderful interview for the listeners. Tell people who we are.
You're listening to Strange Fruit Podcast. The work we do on Strange Fruit wouldn't be possible without your support. If we've made you laugh
or made you think,
we hope you'll consider chipping in.
Visit donate.strangefruitpod.org.
That's donate@strangefruitpod.org. Thank you. Welcome back. You're listening to Strange Fruit Podcast.
Welcome back to listeners. So a few weeks ago, Doc, I was on Facebook, and there's a Facebook friend of mine named Elle Dowd. Elle lives, she lives in the Chicagoland area, and she, I love her work. She does a lot of really wonderful kind of anti-racist work at the intersection of religion and spirituality. And so, you know, I really admire the people in my friend group and social media kind of clique who work for racial justice and social justice in areas outside of my own kind of thing. Like, I'm kind of like a, I don't know, but, you know, I'm religious, but I'm not super religious. And so I love that people.
Yes.
And I think that's a really important area as I began to read the piece that we're going to discuss today, y'all, with the author, that I think that's probably maybe like an uncharted territory, or not maybe not uncharted, people who are doing work there, but also maybe an underaddressed area, right? We presume that, yeah, we need to do anti-racist work in schools. We need to do anti-racist work, you know, in the prison system and society at large, but we don't remember our nation's own storied history with racist religious institutions, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess we also kind of presume, or at least I did, that naively that, you know, that all religious folk or all super godly folk are anti-racist or somehow not otherwise problematic, right? And so
mm-hmm.
I was really appreciative to read this particular piece. So Elle had put out a call to her friend group as a faith leader who does anti-racist work and asked a very simple question, that question being why white folks who are in interracial relationships should care about anti-racist work, right? Because we also presume that, again, if you're married to a white person or a black person, or you're multiracial, rather, if you're a white person married to a black person or a multiracial person or Latinx person, that somehow you get it. Or that somehow it has to be effortless, and that's not always true. And so all that to say, listeners, the piece was on Medium.com. It's called Racial Trauma in My Interracial Marriage. Please welcome to the show the writer of that piece, Medina Maxine. How are you, Medina?
Hello. Thank you for having me. I'm doing well. Thank you.
Glad to hear that. So when I mentioned, you know, Elle put out this call to a particular circle and asked folks who are invested in the issue why white folks in interracial relationships should care about anti-racist work. And so you began to describe in this piece your own marriage of 21 years that I think it recently ended, and that you yourself were in an interracial relationship. And that relationship was very much informed by, or at least surrounded by, a lot of church, you know, good, upstanding white church folk, right? But that somehow you still saw racist attitudes manifested among these people who would have considered themselves to be like good Christian folk. But so just tell us a bit about how you came to write this piece, you know, what the call to action was, and what made you say, like, I got something I can share about this issue.
Sure. Well, I had seen Elle post a request for anyone interested in writing a piece in regards to anti-racist work and interracial couplings. And I had just been going through a whole host of counseling and trauma work, and had discovered that, you know, of course, in trauma work, you're going back in your childhood and you're looking at things. And I knew that there were things that had happened in my life. And of course, yes, that shaped who I was. But what I didn't realize is how much shame I was carrying due to racial trauma and things that had been told to me as a child, one of the things, I don't think I mentioned it in the piece, but what I remember, one of my earliest memories was that people would call me devil's child or spawn of the devil because I was multiracial.
Wow. Oh, wow.
And that is a deep spiritual wound. And it was something, again, that I didn't realize until I started this trauma work. But I did a lot of volunteer work in different prayer ministries and healing prayer ministries. And so I could understand the spiritual ramifications of different lies that were told throughout our lives, right? Some of those not even related to race. But throughout that work, I kept thinking, like, there was a peace within me that I kept feeling like there was just this dark center or dark core in me. And it was really strange for me to kind of process through that, because I have always been someone that I haven't hidden anything from God, right?
Yeah.
So even when I have lived in rebellion and made some really crazy choices, God was always in it. And I was always having conversation with God. There was never anything that I would withhold from him. So I thought it odd that I would have this sense that there was this dark center. And when I went through EMDR therapy and I had this visual of people saying those things to me, I realized that's what that dark center was.
Yeah.
That was the lie that had been told to me, and that it wasn't in my conscious mind, but it was underground, right, ruminating in my mind and impacting the decisions that I had made. And so that kind of opened up the whole, wow, there is this Grand Canyon sized wound here related to race. And so I started looking at the different things that had occurred growing up. As I mentioned in my piece, I was separated from my husband, and there were very serious issues in the marriage is why we're separated. But it was when I looked at the fact that he was surrounding himself with people who were openly racist, unapologetically racist, and he wouldn't say anything to these people about it.
Yes.
He thought it was okay to be in relationship and friendships with these people, with me as his wife. And so that was kind of the turning point of, you know, I think that I could live through this other stuff, but this is you surrounding yourself with people who don't even appreciate my existence as a human being.
Yeah.
And so that was where I kind of was like, I can't, this won't work. And it wasn't until I left that I looked through the history of our relationship and remembered these different things that had happened. And like I said in the piece, I had been groomed to accept that this was the behavior I should receive. So a little background, my mom was Irish and German. My dad was African, Native American, and French. And I grew up in an all-white small town. And so I didn't have my first brown friend until 3 years ago. So I didn't have anybody in my life who looked like me. And I was definitely in environments where people would forget that I was in the room, right? And would say different things.
Wow, thank you for sharing that history. I'm going to say yes. So it's very interesting that you almost found yourself repeating or duplicating some of the experiences that your own parents had. As you mentioned, you know, your mom being quote-unquote white, your dad being quote-unquote black, and there was something that happened at the age. So as you began to do your trauma healing work, you're beginning to realize that some of the things you carried around with you was this kind of racialized trauma. It's all, I think, to me, in my opinion, all black folk have this kind of racialized trauma, race memory. But when you were 7 years old, your dad took you somewhere, took you someplace in particular down in Georgia. Where did you and your dad go, and what had happened there?
Well, it actually wasn't me and my dad. It was my dad who was 7 years old and his uncle took him out to the woods where a black man had been lynched, and they continued to use his body for target practice until there was basically nothing, obviously, left of his body. And through EMDR therapy, I went back to that memory of my dad, because I would have, I'm typically a feisty person, kind of a fight, right?
Yes.
But there are certain scenarios that I would just completely freeze and be overwhelmed and couldn't make a decision. And I didn't know where this was coming from. So through EMDR, I had gone back to my dad standing there as a brown-bodied young boy looking in the tree and seeing this brown body hanging there and wondering
what. So the body was literally like your dad was able to see that this body had literally, this is not a, like an exaggerated story, like the body literally was left there. People come and shoot arrows or guns at it, and it stayed there.
Yes, the body had literally been left in the tree after the person died, and people had continued to use the body for target practice. And so for a 7-year-old brain to be able to see that and not process it, to be able to see that this person looked like me, what does that mean for me? What does that mean for my humanity, right? And is there a safe place for me? Where can I go to find safety? And is there any safety? Because his uncle had told him the reason he brought him out there was that he wanted him to see what people were capable of doing, which sounds like a horrendous thing to do. And I was angry at his uncle for the longest time. However, it was on his part he was trying to protect, right? Not an effective, healthy way, but I think his intentions were to protect him, to say, you have to be careful.
Yeah. Your piece was very, very compelling, and I think very necessary when it comes to conversations around race, especially involving romantic and love connections. You talk about not only with the incident of lynching, you know, kind of replicated and ingrained in your father's DNA from him viewing this, but that you inherited this legacy through your own DNA. And then you go into talking about how growing up in the church as a kid, you and your family would go to church, and people would try to do what after you all would leave the church? Folks in the community, folks who identified as Christian, folks who identified as having God in their hearts, what were the incidents that you describe in your piece of their reaction to you and your family?
Right. There were times that we would go home from church or drive around on Sunday after church, and people would swerve their cars. People would make a notion. They would kind of point their finger and then throw their thumb up, like, get out of town type of thing. And growing up, I always thought, you know, Dad, you're making this up. You're blowing things out of proportion. And then as I got older, I began to recognize that. And honestly, the majority of the trauma and the pain that people have caused has been from people in the church. And so I think this is why there's this huge push, right, in anti-racist movements for the church to confess and for the church to repent, because these were church people that were lynching people back in the day, right? These are church people who are slave owners, and these are church people today that I have served with, that I have prayed with, that I have been in community with, that don't even, I think sometimes, honestly, don't even understand the racist bias that comes out of their mouth. And I think one of the important things that Ellie wanted to point out good, kind, quote unquote, good, kind, God-fearing people who are racist. I think part of the difficulty is that racism becomes synonymous with hatred, right? Mm-hmm. And so we talk about racists, And then we talk about hatred. And there are so many quote-unquote good, kind, God-fearing Christian people who say, but I don't hate anybody. So they don't think that they're racist.
No,
okay,
certainly.
Well, you may not hate somebody. You may not be out lynching someone, but you also don't see me as an equal person to you.
Yeah. Right, right. And I mean, do you think that this kind of thinking, right, the fact that the white folks that were doing this to you and your family after church and not connecting racism, you know, disconnecting racism from hatred, also gave way to your father's own anti-black sentiments? You discuss in your piece about how your dad, when you're growing up, he would watch TV and any black person he saw placating or operating within some kind of black stereotype, he would give y'all a 10-minute lecture. Talk to our listeners a bit about what it was like to have your black father kind of express anti-black attitudes as a young person.
It was, I didn't really understand. I understand it now from reading that we live in white supremacist ideas and thinking, and we're all indoctrinated with that regardless of what color we are. And it was confusing for me, but I had a very much, I was thinking about this today. I was reading an article about a black woman who had been adopted by a white family. And even though I had a black dad, that's very much how I think I feel and grew up, because I wasn't around other black people. I wasn't around black culture. And so for him to speak the way that he did and for him to keep us in all white culture was telling me that white culture was better, that white culture was the way that I would get to wherever I wanted to be in life, to be successful, was to emulate that culture and not to embrace the wholeness of myself. And so I'm 49 years old, and I'm just now learning to love and embrace my whole self, and I'm discovering my roots and my heritage, and I'm just now developing friends with other brown and black bodied people and women who look like me.
Would you talked a bit about your family, and I want to talk a bit about your marriage. You there were a number, as you kind of look back, a number of situations that you found yourself in with his family. I don't think we mentioned yet. So what happened? There was one thing in particular that happened on even your wedding night. A couple of things happened. But yeah, what happened over your wedding night? And then did you and your husband ever have conversations where you challenged him to not be such an accommodationist? Or did you somehow not realize these things until after the marriage had ended, that he was really so complicit in the racism?
You know, it's one of those things that hindsight is 20/20. I look back now, and it was all there from the very beginning, and I just sort of overlooked it because I was in love with this person, right? And even though this person had friends in their life who would make racist comments and jokes, and family members, I thought he was different, right? Because he didn't say those things. But he also didn't call those things out as wrong. He also didn't stand up for me in the midst of those things. And so one of the things that I mentioned is we were sitting around putting birdseed bags together for our wedding. And it was myself and his family. So he came from a large family, had several aunts, cousins surrounded around the table. And one of his aunts said something, told a joke, something, something, and nigger babies. And I sat there for a minute, like, did that just happen? And it was almost as if the air was sucked out of the room, right? And there was an acknowledgement and an embarrassment that this had slipped out with me there. But it wasn't an acknowledgement or an embarrassment or a conviction that this is saying this type of joke is wrong anywhere, right? And so then on our wedding day, we had both of our pastors preside over our wedding, but it was at his church because his church was larger, and again, he had a large family. And so I noticed as people are coming through the reception line, every single person is saying to me, oh my goodness, you're so lucky, you're so fortunate. Person after person, you're so lucky, you're so fortunate. And I thought, well, what is he not fortunate and lucky to be marrying me? And suddenly it dawned on me that I was fortunate and lucky to be marrying this white man and into this white family, is the message that I interpreted.
Yeah. No, certainly. And I really appreciated that about your piece. Like, why wasn't he lucky? Why didn't anyone say, oh, wow, he really lucked out with you, or you're a prize? And what it hints at, even you're talking about learning early on to reject blackness and to reject black folk, and that included romantically, right, sexually, to
right.
only kind of value white bodies and to see whiteness as better. And so it seems as if the comments were rooted in the fact that, you know, dating, romance, marriages are inherently political, in as much as we like to think about them as only romantic or desire-filled, but they hint at a politic, right? And the fact
yes.
that you right, you realize that, oh, wow, I've been preferring white bodies this whole time. Talk to us a bit about how romance, dating, attraction, all those things are also wrapped up in politics, politics of race, class, right? The fact that people say, oh, you married well. What are they really meaning and inferring by that?
Right, right. Because you're marrying up into another mm-hmm. class, right?
Yep.
So I had never been, again, I grew up in an all-white community, so I never had access to brown-bodied men. I went to college, to a private college, and I think there were a handful of brown-bodied people who were from the United States. The majority of brown-bodied people were international students. And I remember two gentlemen specifically, and I didn't, again, I didn't realize this at the time. This is me looking back and realizing it now. There were two gentlemen that, brown-bodied gentlemen that were, I was somewhat attracted to. And the one actually showed interest back to me. And I was hesitant and then never pursued it. And I don't remember at the time what I wrote it off as, like why I didn't pursue that that interest. But when I look back at it now, and having done some of this racial healing work, it is absolutely 100% because I had been conditioned to prefer white bodies, specifically. Typically, the Aryan, the blonde hair, blue-eyed boys.
Yeah.
What advice would you have for folks out there who might be listening to this episode and are struggling with those same types of things, being raised in a kind of well-intentioned but anti-Black environment, not feeling connected to their own cultural experience, you know, recognizing, wow, I prefer white bodies too. What is your advice to folks out there that might be struggling to kind of live in their own truth as you have come to do now?
My advice, and really a big part of why I wanted to write this, is because although my narrative is very complex, it is not unique to me. So there are other people out there living with these same types of experiences. And my advice would be to find a place, therapist, counselor, spiritual director, somewhere where you can begin to look at these things and do some self-reflection and do your own healing work. And when I say that, I'm almost hesitant because people might say, well, I don't have any healing work to do. I'm just fine. So I would say to them, just be open to exploring the possibility that you may be preferring something because this is the water that you live in. Be open to the fact that you might say racism doesn't exist today, and people that talk about racism are the divisive ones, that it's possible that you don't really believe that, but you say it in order not to rock the boat, to get along with the white people that you are in and amongst and love and have friendships with. And definitely to pursue those possibilities before you get into a serious, permanent relationship. Because in my experience with this, and I hate, it's really hard for me to say this as a seminary student, as a budding pastor, love doesn't conquer all. Love might conquer all if your eyes are open to what needs to be conquered. But love isn't going to conquer something that you're in denial about.
I love it. I tell you what, this has certainly been not just a cautionary tale, but also just such an eye-opening. There's been so much I disenjoyed, from the notion of introspection and dealing with childhood racial traumas, to, like, you know, just because we love each other doesn't mean that this thing is going to work. And, you know, and also, what does it mean to be someone who's not actively racist, you know, but also to allow and tolerate folks around you to make comments. And so there was just so much I really, really enjoyed about your piece. I'm so excited that when I reached out to you on Facebook that you were willing to come on the show and talk about it. And, you know, we've learned so much from you, and I just wish you the best of luck with everything.
Thank you. Thank you. I hope that something that I said plants a seed somewhere for healing.
For
someone to avoid some of the turbulent seasons and spaces and roads that I've gone down.
Absolutely. Well, it's definitely been helpful. Please take care. Bye-bye.
Oh, thank you.
All right, Doc, let's take a quick break. Tell the people who we be.
You're listening to Strange Fruit Podcast.
Support for LPM Podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
All right, so thanks to today's wonderful guest, Ariel Gore, Medina Maxine. Two wonderful conversations. The first, of course, about Hex. I've been saying, of course, a lot this entire episode. I don't know why I keep saying it. I'm like, something, of course. And you're like, no, not
well,
of course.
Well, because, like, with our loyal fruitcakes and listeners, they people do, know what time it is. Like, it's just a given. So,
well, you know, when I was a kid, you know, my mother, you know, for example, when I was a kid, and, you know, people have vocal, you call it vocal tics, so we just vocal tendencies. So when you're talking to somebody, you say something like, you know, something, you know, my mother would always say, no, I don't know. It's because she was teaching me that there are certain things that we say in the English language, in Americans, for example, you know, or like, and those are things that we don't really have to say them. And so mother would just tell me that instead of saying like, or I'd be like, hi, my name, like, don't say, just take a pause, right? And so she helped me to kind of get myself out of, and the public speaker and the kid, instead of saying a lot, those people say every other word. Like, she would say, don't say just take a pause.
Or
people say something like, it was like don't say like, just take a pause. So anyway, I don't know why I keep saying of course, but I wanted to say thank you to the wonderful guest today. Hex of the Patriarchy is a wonderful book, and of course, Medina Maxine for talking about what the interracial relationship situation. Yeah,
I really enjoyed both guests this week. They were phenomenal, and oh, there I go with you know.
That's okay. Our listeners have come to know and love all of our idiosyncratic vocal tendencies and all of those things that probably annoyed them the first season or second season. By season number 7, they've come to love those things about us. Right, listeners? Yes, agreed.
Okay, yes.
Well, so, Doc, I've been having a great time in Baltimore. It's coming to a close.
I'm so glad that you've been spending time with Tori, though.
I have. And I've been eating lots of seafood, which, you know, I've been a heaven child.
I know.
You can go get live crab, live lobster child. They got an international market. I mean, I just love it. Like, so, for example, like, even in the cereal, like, this is a wondrous variety. So, even in the cereal aisle, like, in Louisville, you might have Rice Krispies. Mm-hmm. Here you have chocolate Rice Krispies. Cinnamon Rice Krispies. Like, right where, like, they, literally everything that we have one of, they have two or three other varieties of it as well. And it's really indulgent, but it's just, I think it's really cool that depending on where you go in the country, there are different options. So up here, the chips up here, for example, are like wrap snacks. And so
Oh my God, wrap snacks crack me up because they had those when I lived in Philly. Don't they have like black people on them?
So last week I had some Cardi B honey barbecue chips.
Yes.
They got the Migos. They got the, it's something with a dab of ranch, like sour cream and onion with a dab of ranch. They have like butter popcorn with Master P. Like, so every flavor of chip has an associated rap star.
I love it.
And then they have these other chips, and I forget the brand, but they're like Doritos, but they're not. So they're tortilla chips, but they're flavored like stadium nachos and cheese. So not Doritos cheese, like the orange cheese, but if you go to a baseball game and get some nachos with the yellow cheese, the peppers, and the chips taste just like a ballpark stadium. Nachos, Doc, they are so good. And they're only 50 cents a bag.
Oh, my God, yes. I remember wrap snacks. And the one I feel like I have a picture of, but it's actually like a printout photo when you used to go to submit your photographs, like, to a place, and you pick them up in an hour.
Yeah.
And it was a picture of a wrap snack bag, and it had three black girls on the front. One was Muslim and had sunglasses.
Yes.
The other one had blonde hair as well as gold teeth. And the other one was, like, schoolgirl realness. I was like,
With a salt and pepper?
Huh?
With the group salt and pepper?
No, that's clever.
It was just some around the way black girls representing their snacks. I love it.
I loved it. I love that East Coast is so unapologetically black.
They got a carry out, a curry out called Hip Hop Chicken. And see, I don't think the Louisvillians know what a carry out is. So Louisvillians and Southerners, are just probably Louisvillians, because other major cities have carryouts. So basically, it's like a chicken joint. So we might have like a chicken joint in Louisville. Other cities have carryouts, so they don't only have chicken. They have subs, cheesesteaks, fried fish. Like, you literally go to like a bodega, like a chicken joint, and buy any kind of food you want. To open late. They got Kool-Aid. You know, they got whatever you need. And so there's one place. It's called Hip Hop Chicken.
Not Hip Hop Chicken.
And best believe it ain't all about nobody black. You know, so it's so funny. It's funny. I don't know. It's funny.
I love it.
I'll be home soon. I'll bring plenty of wrap snacks.
Please bring plenty of wrap snacks, different flavors and everything, so we can take pics.
I got you. But as for today, we are out of time. So please say goodbye.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.
Strange Fruit is produced by Louisville Public Media. Our engineer is Koja Tashiro, who also composed our theme music. For more information about Strange Fruit, visit strangefruitpod.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at Strange Fruit Pod.
The views expressed on Strange Fruit do not reflect those of Louisville Public Media, its staff, or its underwriters. Strange Fruit is produced by me, Kyla Story.
And me, Jason Gardner.
Thanks for listening.